Chapter 56. If the desire to kill and the opportunity to kill came always together, who would escape hanging? Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. On the train. 50 years ago, when I was a boy in the then remote and sparsely peopled Mississippi Valley, vague tales and rumors of a mysterious body of professional murderers came wandering in from a country which was constructively as far from us as the constellations blinking in space, India. Vague tales and rumors of a sect called thugs, who waylaid travelers in lonely places, and killed them for the contentment of a god whom they worshipped. Tales which everybody liked to listen to and nobody believed, except with reservations. It was considered that the stories had gathered bulk on their travels. The matter died down and a lull followed. Then Eugene Sue's Andering Jew appeared, and made great talk for a while. One character in it was a chief of thugs, Aringia, a mysterious and terrible Indian who was as slippery and sly as a serpent, and as deadly, and he stirred up the thug interest once more. But it did not last. It presently died again, this time to stay dead. At first glance it seems strange that this should have happened, but really it was not strange, on the contrary, it was natural, I mean on our side of the water. For the source whence the thug tales mainly came was a government report, and without doubt was not republished in America, it was probably never even seen there. Government reports have no general circulation. They are distributed to the few, and are not always read by those few. I heard of this report for the first time a day or two ago, and borrowed it. It is full of fascinations, and it turns those dim, dark fairy tales of my boyhood days into realities. The report was made in 1889 by Major Sleeman, of the Indian Service, and was printed in Calcutta in 1840. It is a clumsy, great, fat, poor sample of the printer's art, but good enough for a government printing office in that old day and in that remote region, perhaps. To Major Sleeman was given the general superintendence of the giant task of ridding India of thuggee, and he and his 17 assistants accomplished it. It was the Augean stables over again. Captain Valancy, writing in a Madras journal in those old times, makes this remark. He day that sees this far-spread evil eradicated from India and known only in name, will greatly tend to immortalize British rule in the East. He did not overestimate the magnitude and difficulty of the work, nor the immensity of the credit which would justly be due to British rule in case it was accomplished. Thuggee became known to the British authorities in India about 1810, but its wide prevalence was not suspected. It was not regarded as a serious matter, and no systematic measures were taken for its suppression until about 1830. About that time Major Sleeman captured Eugene Sue's thug-chief, Faringia, and got him to turn King's evidence. The revelations were so stupefying that Sleeman was not able to believe them. Sleeman thought he knew every criminal within his jurisdiction, and that the worst of them were merely thieves. But Faringia told him that he was in reality living in the midst of a swarm of professional murderers, that they had been all about him for many years, and that they buried their dead close by. These seemed insane tales, but Faringia said come and see, and he took him to a grave, and dug up 100 bodies, and told him all the circumstances of the killings, and named the thugs who had done the work. It was a staggering business. Sleeman captured some of these thugs, and proceeded to examine them separately, and with proper precautions against collusion, for he would not believe any Indian's unsupported word. The evidence gathered proved the truth of what Faringia had said, and also revealed the fact that gangs of thugs were plying their trade all over India. The astonished government now took hold of thuggee, and for 10 years made systematic and relentless war upon it, and finally destroyed it. Gang after gang was captured, tried, and punished. The thugs were harried and hunted from one end of India to the other. The government got all their secrets out of them, and also got the names of the members of the bands, and recorded them in a book, together with their birthplaces and places of residence. The thugs were worshippers of Boani, and to this god they sacrificed anybody that came handy, but they kept the dead man's things themselves, for the god cared for nothing but the corpse. Men were initiated into the sect with solemn ceremonies. Then they were taught how to strangle a person with a sacred choke cloth, but were not allowed to perform officially with it until after long practice. No half-educated strangler could choke a man to death quickly enough to keep him from uttering a sound, a muffled scream, gurgle, gasp, moan, or something of the sort, but the expert's work was instantaneous. The cloth was whipped around the victim's neck, there was a sudden twist, and the head fell silently forward, the eyes starting from the sockets, and all was over. The thug carefully guarded against resistance. It was usual to get the victims to sit down, for that was the handiest position for business. If the thug had planned India itself, it could not have been more conveniently arranged for the needs of his occupation. There were no public conveyances. There were no conveyances for hire. The traveler went on foot or in a bullock cart, or on a horse which he bought for the purpose. As soon as he was out of his own little state or principality, he was among strangers. Nobody knew him, nobody took note of him, and from that time his movements could no longer be traced. He did not stop in towns or villages, but camped outside of them, and sent his servants in to buy provisions. There were no habitations between villages. Whenever he was between villages, he was an easy prey, particularly as he usually traveled by night, to avoid the heat. He was always being overtaken by strangers who offered him the protection of their company, or asked for the protection of his, and these strangers were often thugs, as he presently found out to his cost. The landholders, the native police, the petty princes, the village officials, the customs officers were in many cases protectors and harborers of the thugs, and betrayed travelers to them for a share of the spoil. At first this condition of things made it next to impossible for the government to catch the marauders. They were spirited away by these watchful friends. All through a vast continent, thus infested, helpless people of every caste and kind moved along the paths and trails in couples and groups silently by night, carrying the commerce of the country, treasure, jewels, money, and petty batches of silks, spices, and all manner of wares. It was a paradise for the thug. When the autumn opened, the thugs began to gather together by pre-concert. Other people had to have interpreters at every turn, but not the thugs. They could talk together, no matter how far apart they were born, for they had a language of their own, and they had secret signs by which they knew each other for thugs, and they were always friends. Even their diversities of religion and caste were sunk in devotion to their calling, and the Muslim and the high caste and low caste Hindu were staunch and affectionate brothers in thuggery. When a gang had been assembled, they had religious worship, and waited for an omen. They had definite notions about the omens. The cries of certain animals were good omens, the cries of certain other creatures were bad omens. A bad omen would stop proceedings, and send the men home. The sword and the strangling cloth were sacred emblems. The thugs worshipped the sword at home, before going out to the assembling place. The strangling cloth was worshipped at the place of assembly. The chiefs of most of the bands performed the religious ceremonies themselves, but the Keats delegated them to certain official stranglers, chores. The rites of the Keats were so holy that no one but the chore was allowed to touch the vessels and other things used in them. Thug methods exhibit a curious mixture of caution and the absence of it. Cold business calculation and sudden, unreflecting impulse, but there were two details which were constant, and not subject to caprice. Patient persistence in following up the prey, and pitilessness when the time came to act. Caution was exhibited in the strength of the bands. They never felt comfortable and confident, unless their strength exceeded that of any party of travelers they were likely to meet by four or fivefold. Yet it was never their purpose to attack openly, but only when the victims were off their guard. When they got hold of a party of travelers, they often moved along in their company several days, using all manner of arts to win their friendship and get their confidence. At last, when this was accomplished to their satisfaction, the real business began. A few thugs were privately detached and sent forward in the dark to select a good killing place and dig the graves. When the rest reached the spot, a halt was called for a rest or a smoke. The travelers were invited to sit. By signs, the chief appointed certain thugs to sit down in front of the travelers, as if to wait upon them, others to sit down beside them and engage them in conversation, and certain expert stranglers to stand behind the travelers and be ready when the signal was given. The signal was usually some commonplace remark, like "ring the tobacco." Sometimes a considerable wait ensued after all the actors were in their places. The chief was biding his time, in order to make everything sure. Meantime, the talk droned on, dim figures moved about in the dull light, peace and tranquility reigned, the travelers resigned themselves to the pleasant reposefulness and comfort of the situation, unconscious of the death angels standing motionless at their backs. The time was ripe now, and the signal came, "colon bring the tobacco." There was a mute swift movement. All in the same instant the men at each victim's side seized his hands, the man in front seized his feet, and pulled, the man at his back whipped the cloth around his neck, and gave it a twist, the head sunk forward, the tragedy was over. The bodies were stripped and covered up in the graves, the spoil packed for transportation. Then the thugs gave pious thanks to Boani, and departed on further holy service. The report shows that the travelers moved in exceedingly small groups, twos, threes, fours, as a rule, a party with a dozen, and it was rare. The thugs themselves seem to have been the only people who moved in force. They went about in gangs of 10, 15, 25, 40, 60, 100, 150, 200, 250, and one gang of 310 is mentioned. Considering their numbers, their catch was not extraordinary, particularly when you consider that they were not in the least fastidious, but took anybody they could get, whether rich or poor, and sometimes even killed children. Now and then they killed women, but it was considered sinful to do it, and unlucky. The season was 6 or 8 months long. One season the half-dozen Bundelkhand and Gwalior gangs aggregated 712 men, and they murdered 210 people. One season the Malwa and Kandish gangs aggregated 702 men, and they murdered 232. One season the Kandish and Bir gangs aggregated 963 men, and they murdered 385 people. Here is the tally sheet of a gang of 60 thugs for a whole season, gang under two noted chiefs, Choti and Sheikh Nangu from Gwalior. F. Pura, in Jhansi, and on arrival at Sarora murdered a traveler. N. Nearly reaching Bhopal, met three Brahmins, and murdered them. Ras the Narbutta, at a village called Hudia, murdered a Hindu. And through Aurangabad to Walago, there met a Havildar of the Barber caste and five sepoys native soldiers, in the evening came to Jokhar, and in the morning killed them near the place where the treasure bearers were killed the year before. Between Jokhar and Dalia met a sepoy of the shepherd caste, killed him in the jungle. Passed through Dalia and lodged in a village 2 miles beyond, on the road to Indore, met a Bairaji beggar holy mendicant, murdered him at the Thapa. In the morning, beyond the Thapa, fell in with 3 Marwari travelers, murdered them. Here a village on the banks of the Tapti met 4 travelers and killed them. Between Chaupra and Dorya met a Marwari, murdered him. T. Dorya met 3 Marwaris, took them 2 miles and murdered them. Wo miles further on, overtaken by 3 treasure bearers, took them 2 miles, and murdered them in the jungle. aim onto Kurgar Batisa in Inder, divided spoil, and dispersed. Total of 27 men murdered on one expedition. Choti, to save his neck, was informer, and furnished these facts. Several things are noticeable about his resume. 1. Business brevity. 2. Absence of emotion. 3. Smallness of the parties encountered by the 60. 4. Variety in character and quality of the game captured. 5. Hindu and Mohammedan chiefs in business together for Bohani. 6. The sacred caste of the Brahmins not respected by either. 7. Nor yet the character of that mendicant, that Bairaji. A beggar is a holy creature, and some of the gangs spared him on that account, no matter how slack business might be. But other gangs slaughtered not only him, but even that sacredest of sacred creatures, the fakir, that repulsive skin and bone thing that goes around naked and mats his bushy hair with dust and dirt, and so befleurs his lean body with ashes that he looks like a specter. Sometimes a fakir trusted a shade too far in the protection of his sacredness. In the middle of a tally sheet of Faringias, who had been out with 40 thugs, I find a case of the kind. After the killing of 39 men and one woman, the fakir appears on the scene. Approaching Dorgo, met 3 pundits, also a fakir, mounted on a pony. He was plastered over with sugar to collect flies, and was covered with them. Drove off the fakir, and killed the other 3. Evening Dorgo, the fakir joined again, and went on in company to Rajana. Met 6 Khatris on their way from Bombay to Nagpur. Drove off the fakir with stones, and killed the 6 men in camp, and buried them in the grove. Next day the fakir joined again, made him leave at Mana. Beyond there, fell in with 2 Khatris and a sepoy, and came on towards the place selected for the murder. When near it, the fakir came again. Losing all patience with him, gave Mathu, one of the gang, 5 rupees, $2, 5.50, to murder him, and take the sin upon himself. All 4 were strangled, including the fakir. Surprised to find among the fakir's effects 30 pounds of coral, 350 strings of small pearls, 15 strings of large pearls, and a gilt necklace. It is curious, the little effect that time has upon a really interesting circumstance. This one, so old, so long ago gone down into oblivion, reads with the same freshness and charm that attached to the news in the morning paper. One's spirits go up, then down, then up again, following the chances which the fakir is running. Now you hope, now you despair, now you hope again. And at last everything comes out right, and you feel a great wave of personal satisfaction go weltering through you, and without thinking, you put out your hand to pat Mathu on the back, when, puff, the whole thing has vanished away, there is nothing there. Mathu and all the crowd have been dust, and ashes and forgotten, oh, so many, many, many lagging years. And then comes a sense of injury. You don't know whether Mathu got the swag, along with the sin, or had to divide up the swag, and keep all the sin himself. There is no literary art about a government report. It stops a story right in the most interesting place. These reports of thug expeditions run along interminably in one monotonous tune: colon met a sepoy, killed him. Met 5 pundits, killed them. Met 4 Rajputs and a woman, killed them, and so on. Till the statistics get to be pretty dry. But this small trip of Faringia's 40 had some little variety about it. Once they came across a man hiding in a grave, a thief. He had stolen 100 rupees from Dunraj Seth of Parati. They strangled him, and took the money. They had no patience with thieves. They killed 2 treasure bearers, and got 4,000 rupees. They came across 2 bullocks, a den with copper pice, and killed the 4 drivers, and took the money. There must have been half a ton of it. I think it takes a double handful of pice to make an anna, and 16 annas to make a rupee, and even in those days the rupee was worth only half a dollar. Coming back over their tracks from Baroda, they had another picturesque stroke of luck. The lowers of a diaper put a traveler in their charge for safety. Dear, dear, across this abysmal gulf of time we still see Feringia's lips uncover his teeth, and through the dim haze we catch the incandescent glimmer of his smile. He accepted that trust, good man, and so we know what went with the traveler. Even Rajas had no terrors for Feringia. He came across an elephant dash driver belonging to the Raja of a diaper and promptly strangled him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.